In Australia and overseas, transport is one of the biggest contributors to emissions in the atmosphere. As Australia attempts to move to a cleaner future through cutting emissions, investing in the carbon credits system has become essential practice by industry through carbon offsets. But will these systems be enough to drive change in the planet? Racers Edge reporter Thomas Kutis speaks to PhD candidate in law, Ferdinand Beaufort from Charles Darwin University. His research focuses on sustainable transport and distributive justice.
The transport sector is a significant emitting source of human activity globally. I think globally it's close to about 20%, but in Australia and New Zealand it's a lot higher because we're quite a lot more reliant on cars. And the carbon credits are a mechanism to try and reduce that on the basis that the polluter pays. By that I mean that if you as a car driver, for example, drive a car and you use 10 liters of petrol a day, you can calculate the number of emissions from that, and you can then work out what should be a reasonable carbon tax on your behavior, which could either be levied at the source of the production, i.e. from the oil company that produces the carbon product, the petrol, or it could be levied in another way further down the supply chain. And the idea is, or the theory is, that if you start to tax things, like you have, for example, taxing tobacco and other what they call sin taxes, then it is supposedly having an impact on behavior and behavioral change. And it will induce people to use less emitting transport modes like walking or biking or maybe micromobility or public transport, because you basically make it economically less interesting to keep polluting more and makes it more interesting to pollute less. So you avoid the carbon tax.
Do you think we're seeing any real impact yet?
No. It's very variable around the world. Research has shown that carbon taxes are really the one and only intervention that, if consistently applied, has an impact. But for many reasons, including population dissent or upset, a lot of countries haven't gone to the point of imposing carbon taxes on, let's say, transport as much as they should. There are exceptions. For Sweden is a very good example. They started very early in the 1990s to first set up systems of reporting and measurement and then imposing a carbon tax. And that stands from memory at around about 130 euros per ton. But many other countries, they have much lower rates. For example, in Singapore, I believe the rate is at the moment about 25 Singapore dollars, and it only applies per ton to the largest emitting companies that emit over 25,000 tons per year. So these two examples just give you a bit of an idea about the variability of carbon tax imposition. And there are lots of other variables that undermine the process of making it effective.
According to the Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water, transport is our third largest emitter, contributing to 22% of Australia's emissions. Are you surprised by that?
No. You see that in countries like Australia and New Zealand that have taken a more, what I would call, American model of urban development and planning, where cities tend to be quite spread out and where people are still highly reliant on cars, on personal cars, to get to work or to go shopping and to get around, basically. And since the 1950s, when the economy started to take off again, the US was quite influential on development with its industry, it was exporting a lot of cars, and autocentricity, as I call it, became a hallmark of countries' development, because it was supposed to be making people free and independent and so on. So a lot of countries actually started to do away with public transport infrastructure, as we saw in New Zealand and Australia, with exceptions like, for example, Melbourne. There's been a real investment back into tram and public transport and so on. But because they're big countries with extended distances and a higher reliance on the private car, you're naturally going to have more emissions from the transport sector and also from logistics.
When it comes to taxing emissions from transport, what do you think is holding us back?
You have examples around the world of governments trying to intervene or trying to address interventions in the petrol market, in the fuel market. It clearly is one of the most important factors in household budgets. You know, when you tank up your car, you are making provisions for a week's commuting and so on, that's a significant impact. And so the householder, the taxpayer, feels the impact of any direct imposition of these carbon taxes very fast. A good example of how excited and how upset people get is in Indonesia during the Suharto era, that I recall, when he tried to remove subsidies on fuels, which led to his government's downfall and the deplorable violence that followed. And that is the potential that you can get, that shows you how sensitive this is, because it affects everybody that is using a car or is using transport or logistics.
Can you explain how carbon credit systems, there may be some pros, but there would be also some cons, to the point where could it actually hurt different communities? So, for example, ones that have a lower economic background and Indigenous communities?
Absolutely. It's a bit like the discussion and debate about goods and services tax or value-added tax around the world. It's a broad-based tax. It would be a broad-based tax, and if you just applied it to everybody, it would be considered a regressive tax, because the burden of GST and the burden of a common universal carbon tax on transport fuels would essentially mean that people with the lowest household income would carry the biggest burden comparatively, because they are likely to spend more of their money or their outgoings in percentage terms on fuels than those at the top end of the income distribution. So it would certainly have an effect there, and you'd have to think about that. And for example, you see in Australia, my PhD research is really about distributive justice and transportation, but I used to do a lot of tax and accounting in my professional life for the last 30 years. But you see that in some countries that try to actually adjust by setting the GST rate at zero for, let's say, staple goods or vegetables. Or I saw an example a couple of days ago on hygienic goods to alleviate the pain. But you are right. If you just do a blanket imposition, then it is more likely that people with lower incomes and more focus on spending on necessities would feel the pinch and be disadvantaged from this.
And then there would be also the other problem where Indigenous communities would be losing their land due to projects like mining projects and construction projects as well.
Yes. I mean, the broad problem globally is really that it is the indigenous people and people in more disadvantaged positions, like in developing countries, that are in the first place more highly affected by the unsustainability of the behaviors of the more richer countries, like the OECD countries, the Western nations, and so on. Because, in effect, the imbalanced emissions per capita in Australia, which are very high by global standards, are caused by behaviors which are quite different from, let's say, people in Pacific Islands who do not have the same luxuries and therefore do not have the same carbon footprint. Mm. So that's already a bad thing. We already start off with a bad case to start imposing taxes across everybody, because it is those people in often former colonial places that are carrying the burden of all the climate change. With the projects like that, what you're discussing with mines and everything else, they already are already disadvantaged, because you see also a lot of cases these projects globally are being done in the backyard of those people, who then carry the direct negative externalities, the impacts from it, like pollution, dispossession of the lands, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Even health impacts as well?
The health impacts are huge. At the moment, in Memphis, in the United States, Elon Musk, for example, set up his Colossus data center. And because he can't get access to energy from the energy grid, he set up gas turbines, which are causing a huge amount of pollution and particulate emissions. And those have a very bad impact on respiratory health. And he set up this data center and these gas turbines to go 24/7 right in the backyard of a community of descendants of American slaves, who are already suffering huge impact from where they live. Because what happens is, you know, where these things are set up, like mining, big industrial complexes, the real estate is severely devalued, and that's often where people on the lower socioeconomic spectrum have to move. They are forced to move there and then have to put up with it. So yes, it is very bad.
Going back to the topic about transport, electric cars, a concern that I have by all this is that we are making decisions to address a cleaner planet with transport, such as producing electric cars, but one of the things that I've realized is that we're still using the mines. We're burning coal to create these cars, and then we also have the lithium ion batteries as well, which cause chemical pollution.
Yeah.
Aren't we destroying the purpose of trying to make a cleaner planet?
That is indeed something I specialize in, because at the moment, as you asked that question, I'm reviewing a carbon certification methodology for electrical vehicles and electrical vehicle charging stations. And I've previously done a lot of work on measuring the end-to-end impacts from these new transport modes from the time that they are built, which includes looking at the supply chain, the lithium, the cobalt, the metals, potential slave labor, human trafficking places, child labor, and how it actually calculates out over the whole lifespan of this vehicle, including when it's disposed of and it needs to be like thrown into landfill, or it sits outside rusting and the batteries are leaking away. And this is the problem with a lot of these policies, and you put your finger on it, is that this is a good thing for us, but then people are not looking at the negative externalities and the distributive justice, like how exactly do these things, these interventions, impact across a community, including indigenous people.
PhD candidate in law Ferdinand Balfort from Charles Darwin University there, speaking to Racist Edge reporter Thomas Kutis, and ending that interview.